While your friends and neighbors are driving from all over the state to get their new vehicles at McMahon Chevy Buick on the corner of Route 15 and Route 100 in Mooresville.
The new McMahon Chevy Buick. We make deals the other guys won't. Chevy, find new roads.
Equal Time. Vermont issues. Vermont voices. Equal Time with Anthony Polina and you.
You poisoned my sweet water. You cut down my green trees. The food you fed my children was the cause of their disease. My world is slowly falling down, and the air's not good to breathe. And those of us who care enough, we have to do something. What you gonna do about me?
Oh. Hello, and welcome to Equal Time Radio. I'm Amy Schallenberger, and I'm hosting the show today. I'm also joined here in the studio today by Anthony Polina, who will be chiming in once in a while. Hey, Anthony.
Hey, once in a while.
Glad you could stop in today.
Well, you know, I think this, what you're going to talk about, is really a really important issue, so I'm glad to have the opportunity to be here for a couple of minutes.
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. First, though, I just want to let listeners know, if you were listening last week, you might want to know that the Agency of Natural Resources has released the draft thermal discharge permit for Vermont Yankee that we were talking about. And if you'd like to find out about that, you can go to the Vermont Citizen Action Network website at vtcitizen.org, and comments are being accepted now. Today, our question is, does class really matter? Do class issues get in the way of activism or collaboration on advocacy issues? We're going to be talking with Betsy Lander Wright of Class Action and author of the book Missing Class to discuss some of these issues. Also later, we'll be joined by Kathleen Geyer, creator of the blog Inequality Matters and host of The Curve, an online forum at The Nation's. One of the questions posed on The Curve forum is, does feminism have a class problem? We'll talk about these issues as well as the causes and consequences of economic inequality and hopefully what we might be able to do about it. Of course, you can join us. Please call in at 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. So our first guest today is Betsy Lander Wright, Program Director at Class Action and author of the new book, Missing Class. Betsy, are you there?
I'm here. Great to be with you, Amy and Anthony.
Thanks. Thanks so much for joining us today. So first off, just give us a little introduction to yourself and tell us a little bit about your work at Class Action.
Yeah, great. Well, I've been an activist mostly working for economic justice for about 30 years, and I've just increasingly seen how much movements for social justice are separated by class, how much we organize not as much across class lines as we could, and how much we don't talk about class, the class composition of our groups, class identities, and class dynamics in our work. And that's one of the themes. Class Action is a national nonprofit that I've been with since it was founded in 2004, so we're at our 10th birthday now. Our mission is to raise awareness of class in the U.S. and classism, and reduce classism in all kinds of fields, but including in social justice groups. And that's the aspect of Class Action's work. If you go to classism.org, you can see we work on classism in educational institutions like schools and in philanthropy and all different aspects. But I specifically work on class and classism within progressive activist groups. And that's what my new book, Missing Class, is about.
So just in case listeners didn't catch it, I want to highly recommend the Class Action website, which is classism.org. I've been a fan of this group for years, and I really appreciate the work that you all are doing. Betsy, tell us, what do you mean when you say class composition of groups? What exactly does that mean, and what do you mean by class in general?
Well, I think class is a hard thing to talk about, in part because it's not just one thing. It's the spectra of how our lives are different depending on our parents' education level and occupation and where we grew up and in what kind of housing and many other factors about our class background, and then similarly about our current life story. It's not just money, but it's class cultures and cultural capital. Things like our accent and way of speaking and who we know, and there's so many aspects to class, and that's one of the things that makes it complicated to talk about. But what I discovered in studying 25 activist groups around the country was that most of them weren't really sure about the class background or class life story, class path of others who they worked with in their voluntary group. And even when people did have some, you know, talk about their own story, of course, people know their own class story, but they often don't use the word class, and we don't have consistent vocabulary. That's another thing that makes it really hard to talk about to people with the same kind of class path, class level and background and current life, won't necessarily use the same term. So, for example, among other things, Class Action is hoping to revive the term working class, which used to be a term of pride and is rarely used anymore. And almost none of the working class activists or people who had working class people in their group or wanted to, almost none of them used that term working class. So that's an example of what I'm talking about class composition. And if you don't know, if you're in a voluntary group, and you don't know who's who. You don't know if maybe you've got people who come from wealthy families in your group or people who grew up in poverty. You miss out on a lot by missing class, because every class life story gives us distinct strengths, and every class culture has distinct limitations, that by not knowing who's who, and just kind of making assumptions based on race or, you know, clothing or some other superficial thing, you can't really tap into the cultural strengths of everyone in your group, or learn from each other, or give people a hand with, you know, whatever people grew up not knowing. We all grew up not knowing something. We have different perspectives on the society depending on our class. So that's the goal of my book, is to get people to get more aware, have those class conversations, and strengthen the group by drawing on the strengths of all class cultures.
So speaking of your book, which is called Missing Class, you did some really cool things in the book. One thing is you looked at some case studies of actual interactions that happened in groups. You watched the groups having meetings and doing actions, and then you interviewed the members of the groups and got their class backgrounds, and then you did analyses about, you know, what was causing them to react the way they did, and you looked at race, gender, and class in your analyses. I'm hoping you'll just give us a few of your favorite examples of some of the things that you found.
Sure, yeah, I'd be glad to. That was a good summary there. It was a 7-year project of studying these 25 groups and writing them into a book. So I figured that was the best way to answer the question of are there activist class cultures and what can we learn from them? Well, one of the most obvious examples that just leapt out at me as soon as I knew what people's class backgrounds were was activists of different classes tend to talk really differently. Not everyone, of course, because there's exceptions to every generalization, but by and large, once I just started re-listening to the audio of interviews and meetings, I could really hear the difference that working class and poor activists who have not gone to four-year college speak much more colorfully, a lot more concretely, using a lot more anecdotes and metaphors. Just I think the word colorful and vivid sums it up. And college-educated activists, especially second or third-generation college-educated, speak much more in generalizations, not just when talking about big, you know, academic topics or big political analysis, but even just in their casual conversation, using general terms like issue and context and strategy and perspective, and omitting those people, places, events, and other vivid concrete details. And I think that one of the things I've been doing on the road, leading workshops to teach people how to draw on the strengths of all class cultures, is to use the best of both of those class speech codes. That'll be the most persuasive, to use generalizations very sparingly when they're really, really, pack a lot of analysis and vision into a particular abstract term, but mostly to speak, some of us, speaking as a third-generation college grad myself, some of us need a little remedial, we got the colorful speech beaten out of us by teachers, we're told not to speak in the first person and things like that, so I think some of us need to relearn that more vivid way of speaking. So I tell a story at the very, very beginning of the book about, well, why would this be a problem? So we speak differently. It was a coalition convened by labor unions that had an annual goal-setting retreat, and they brought in a person with an advanced degree, lifelong professional middle-class activist, to be the outside facilitator. And she gave instructions to the union members who were about to go into small groups and discuss their priorities for the goals for the year for the coalition. And she made this very long statement that had no concrete reference to people or almost no places, events, and used a lot of terms like participation and mobilization, leadership development opportunities, review the process, strategic planning. And when people went into small groups and then reported back out to the whole big coalition meeting, not one of them mentioned any of those terms. She had asked them to put these possible objectives in light of these benchmarks towards these goals, and no one used any of her terms. Instead, they made these really concrete, specific political priority suggestions, like let's go after the mall developer who's union busting, and let's work on the national health care debate, and let's call the firefighters and see if anybody has a retirees list and see if we can get them to come out to our picket line. And at the end of the meeting, and both ways of talking are fine. It wasn't that they misunderstood each other. It's not that they didn't like the outside facilitator, Zoe. They liked her. But at the end of the meeting, she and the two professional middle-class union leaders who headed up the coalition, all three of them said they were disappointed that they didn't get the guidance from the members that they wanted, that they weren't really sure how to take this input and steer the group. So, there was like a failure to connect. They had two different ways of thinking about activism, two different language codes, and they ended up not really getting the momentum towards their goals that they wanted. So that's an example of what I'm talking about. I'm not saying there's a lot of class conflict where people of different classes fight within voluntary groups, or that they literally can't understand each other. But by not really knowing or talking about these cultural differences, we end up not reaching our social justice goals as well as we could.
So just to let listeners know, we're talking with Betsy Lander Wright about her new book, Missing Class. You can join our conversation by calling 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255, and you can find information about this book and the issues that we're talking about at classism.org. So, Betsy, you coined at least one new term in your book, and I really loved this particular one. I was hoping you would talk with us a little bit about inessential weirdness.
Yes. Oh, I'm so glad you're asking. I coined this way back in the late 70s when I was in the anti-nuclear power movement, my first movement, and I figured this was my chance to get it immortalized in print. So back then, the counterculture style was more like hippie you know, what people now call a crunchy granola style. And the anti-nuclear power movement, even though lots of people of all classes and subcultures oppose nuclear power plants, especially those whose electric rates were going to go up and who were going to be poisoned by radiation near them, the movement itself remained quite subculturally specific, that not too many people joined who weren't, back in those days, like men with long hair was one of the subcultural, countercultural markers, and women not shaving, and the types of clothing and types of language, and eating vegetarian food like tofu, which is still a countercultural marker today. What I gradually, and I was like that. That was my style too. But we were trying to build a coalition with consumer groups and neighborhood groups and unions to oppose a nuclear power plant. And what I observed was that all these potential allies were really alienated by these counterculture things. And there was, you just didn't have to be a counterculture, have a counterculture lifestyle in order to oppose nuclear power plants. But the people were really resistant to changing their clothes or their food or whatever. And I give this example where we were with a senior citizens group that was mostly blue-collar guys, and my anti-nuclear buddies said, hey, for a break in the meeting, let's howl like wolves. And they did it. They went, woo, they howled, which, and I just saw these guys, the guys from the senior group, like looking at each other and rolling their eyes and being like, why are we in with these wackos? So one of the pieces of concrete advice I'm able to give for working across class with people who you don't share tastes and styles with, which is often true that tastes and styles are different. And the clothing was really different between classes, and the people who dress really, really, really scruffy usually are from the most privileged class backgrounds, like in the anarchist subculture sometimes, or just anti-war, et cetera. But that one of the ways you can bridge class differences is to just let go of your inessential weirdnesses. And the reason I call them the things that you're doing outreach to more people who are more mainstream, working class people, more mainstream than yourself, if you're in that position, and just blend in a little bit more. And the reason I say inessential weirdnesses is because I think there also are essential weirdnesses. Like Linda Stout, the author of Bridging the Class Divide, talks about organizing working class and low-income grassroots people in South Carolina, or North Carolina, excuse me, in the Piedmont region, and where there was a lot of homophobia based on religion and so forth, and that they decided they had to oppose homophobia and be welcoming to LGBT people. This was back in the 80s, and they just knew that they were going to lose a lot of people, but it just wasn't right. Their intention was to be welcoming to being against all oppressions and welcoming to everyone. So that was a weirdness that was absolutely essential. And I've seen other situations like that where I was a grassroots, I was a community organizer for many years, and sometimes, Christianity is the only religion people are familiar with. They'd like to start the meetings with prayers to Jesus, and it's just not right for the Jewish organizer or the minority religion, the one Muslim in the neighborhood or apartment complex or whatever. So there's times when you have to just go ahead and be weird because it would be really exclusionary not to. But if it's just a matter, don't impose your kind of food on uninterested people. Don't go around being superior, acting greener than thou. So I'm speaking to my fellow college-educated radicals here, because not everybody has the problem of inessential weirdnesses. But if there's a counterculture that attracts you, don't assume that it's going to attract grassroots people that you're doing outreach to, and just let it go. I know somebody, a guy who proudly kept his long hair down to his waist, from the 60s right through the 80s, but then he got a job that involved outreach to grassroots people who weren't already activists, and he chopped it off and he got a conventional men's haircut, even though it was very important to him. His hair was a very important symbol to him, but he knew it would be read wrong. So that's what an inessential weirdness is something like his hair, and what I'm advocating is something like he did of chopping it off. We just don't want our style differences and the fact that, you know, it's more elite people by and large who are more bohemian. We don't want that marker of class difference to get in their way of a cross-class alliance.
Thanks for explaining that. So one of the things that struck me in your book, you have this great chart. You have many, many great illustrations, but one is this chart, sort of like a cross, and it shows the spectrum of the different classes, and you sort of place on the chart where different groups that you've identified fall. One of the things that struck me is it's kind of like getting a Myers-Briggs test, but you can do it to yourself. Yeah. And I'm wondering if you see any future where we treat class in the same sort of way that we treat Myers-Briggs, and if so, you know, how could we get there? How could we sort of be in a group and say, well, Betsy, you know, you come from a higher class background than I do, and we both have strengths, and there are some things that are going to be weird to both of us, but we'd really like to work together.
I love that analogy, and, you know, one of my favorite things about the Myers-Briggs personality test is that, you know, there's 16 types based on 4 spectrums, and that they're all good. They're all positive. They're all recognized to have strengths, as well as, of course, things that you're not so strong on. And that's the class actions frame on class cultures of what we learn from our class backgrounds, that they're all strengths. But, of course, the society we live in, they're not treated equally at all. That there's huge power differences and status differences, and that by and large, the ideal professional middle class culture is treated as what everyone should aspire to, and that's the kids who are going to get promoted to the next grade and put into the higher tracks, and that's the people who are going to get promoted and put in charge because that's the ideal of how to be. As if there are no downsides, which I can tell you from personal experience, there really are, blind spots, things where you grow up sheltered like I did, and there's just things you don't understand about the society, and there tend to be some real personality flaws that you're not stuck with them, but you start with them. So we when we're missing class, we're overlooking the downsides of more class-privileged upbringings, what they leave us with. And, of course, we're overwhelmingly treating working class and poor people as being nothing but a bunch of deficits, when, in fact, study after study shows that there are strengths, personality strengths, as well as, of course, additional kinds of knowledge that are very valuable when you're working for social justice, knowledge of what the downside of the society looks like from being targeted by it. There's so many strengths of working class and poor cultures, they are, they're just missing from most of the stuff about remedial education and within the social justice world, within the idea of empowerment and leadership development. So I would love if we could get to the place where I'd love to get to the place where there's no classism and no class exploitation or poverty at all. But I think we'll always be different in our occupations and our class cultures. Even in a healthy society, class actions vision is a world without classism, which would mean everyone's basic needs are met, but there still need to be different kinds of work that gets done, and people will choose different types and amounts of education. Even in a much healthier society. So I'd like to see that seen as, equality of human respect, that we respect what people have learned from their life stories and feel like anyone you meet, there's something you can learn from them. we're nowhere near there. We're nowhere near the Myers-Briggs ideal of learning, all learning from every life experience.
Well, I hope you can help to get us there. So Anthony Polina is sitting here in the studio with me, quietly absorbing what you're saying. And I'm wondering, Anthony, if you want to ask any questions or make a comment before we let Betsy go.
Well, two things, actually. I wanted to go back to one thing you said about certain people, certain class of people being using certain kinds of words. And you gave an example. And what came to mind to me, it sounds like a criticism, not of you, but of those people. I don't know whether you would agree that sometimes the higher educated, sort of higher class folks were using words that seemed more vague, as opposed to the working class people you talked about, who were being kind of more direct and more colorful. And I sometimes think people who are being vague or being more are being safer, you know, by not sort of using words that are direct and sort of putting things on the line. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, it does. I mean, you could see it as like fear or caution, and you know, not taking risks by being specific. And maybe you're right in some cases, but I think it's a very deeply ingrained habit from just childhood, because it was just an overwhelming finding. I did word counts on all these words per 10,000 words of speech by class, and it's just what pops out of people's mouths. So I think we have these predispositions towards a certain way of speaking that we have to overcome. I also think that that in this case also that there's I may have made it sound like most of the advantages are with the working class and poor people's ways of talking more vividly, and I think that is a wonderful speech code that many people need to practice more. But if you only tell stories and you don't sum them up in, with a really big analysis, that has been shown in the psychosocial research to not motivate action as much. So I think the best really is both. In the workshops that I'm leading around the country on book tour, we're practicing using the best of both those speech codes to come up with a persuasive message to get people to jump on board with an issue that they're not convinced of yet. And so we practice, I dropping all those words like, perspective, network, outreach, context that are just vague. Issue, the word issue means like nothing really. But there are words like, think of the meaning of the term sustainability to the environmental movement, that it's this ideal of what a better economy and a better environment would look like. It's a criterion against which you can test various technologies or activities or whatever. So it's just it packs a lot. And to have a small number of ones like that encompass your vision or your analysis. One example of a group, an organization whose mission is very closely tied to promoting a single unknown jargon term is my own organization, Class Action, because we say one of the ways we'll know when we've succeeded, is when classism and classist become household words, which they're not now. Most people don't know them, don't use them, but we really want to convince people, and so we use that word, and we try to, in our illustrations of it, we give really concrete examples.
I think you're right in that. Speaking from our own experience up here in Vermont, I mean, we do lots of wonderful things dealing with a lot of sort of social and cultural issues, and we're okay on economic issues as well, but it's a lot harder to get people to talk about poverty and economic issues and class issues than it is to get them to talk about, you know, marriage equality as an example, which is certainly a good thing that I support, but it's just harder to get people to talk about class. It sort of strikes closer to home than a lot of people would like to believe, I think. And, you know, the need to like talk more about inequality and classism and what it means to us and how we have to deal with that in order to have an economic recovery or a fair economy, the kind of recovery that we'd really want to have. we have to deal with these issues, and we don't talk about them enough.
So, Anthony, Jack's given me the eye. I think we have to take a break. Betsy, thank you so much for joining us today. And for listeners, please check out classism.org.
My pleasure. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to Blues in the Night. Blues in the Night, a joyous theatrical celebration of great American music, brings down the house at Lost Nation Theater, July 10th through 27th. Three women, one man, and the music that gets them through the night.
My mama done told me.
Lost Nation's multicultural cast wails 26 smoking tunes, sorrowful, sweet, and sexy. From Bessie Smith, Duke Ellington, Benny Goodman, Alberta Hunter, and more, July 10 through 27.
When I hear two sweethearts spoon, nobody knows you when you're down and out.
I gotta write the same book.
Visit LostNationTheater.org.
School's out. Where can you get great summer fun stuff for the kids? Northfield Pharmacy is your summer fun hotspot with the cute hot weather items for the gang. Like bubbles, clutch straw shooter jets, clutch foxtails, and more. Need to cool the kids off with something more creative? Try science projects. Buy Copernicus toys plus indoor rainy day clutch arts and crafts toys, including puzzles and puzzle books. Shop Northfield Pharmacy, your family first community centered pharmacy. Depot Square, downtown Northfield.
Welcome back to Equal Time Radio. I'm Amy Schallenberger, and I'm here in the studio with Anthony Polina, and we're talking about how class issues can affect our activism. If you want to join us, you can call 244-1777 or 1-877-291-8255. So, Anthony, have you seen any examples of the sort of issues that Betsy was talking about and the work you've been doing over the years?
Well, certainly seen the way the difficulty or the challenge there is in bringing together people from various economic strata to work together, and part of it is that maybe they have different interests, and part of it is that they have different ability to give of time and energy sometimes. I mean, you know, working with dairy farmers, which I did for a long time, I mean, it's almost like a cliche, but it's true that they just work really hard all the time, and they have a language all their own, and it is hard to get them to come out together and meet with other people. I think we made and continue to make. Well, you worked with dairy farmers as well.
Yep, following in your footsteps.
And we have made great strides. I shouldn't say we have. I think Vermont has made great strides in sort of bringing together those folks so that we can better understand the importance of agriculture and what those issues have meant to Vermont. And I think the average Vermonter has a better understanding of milk prices than they used to, and I think dairy farmers have a better idea of sustainability than they used to, and I think that's an example of where we've made some great progress. And I think more recently we've had some good conversations in Vermont about the issues around, well, it came up around the right to organize with child care workers and home health workers and the kind of work they do. And, you know, they've been very blunt about, and I don't mean blunt in a negative way, but very clear about what their work means to them and to the community. And I think you sort of peel back the veil of not secrecy, but of unawareness that sort of covers a lot of what goes on in our economy. And I think one of the things that we've had a hard time doing in Vermont still is understanding that the class issues that she was talking about, and we're talking about, whether we talk about them out loud or not, they're in some ways they are getting worse. I mean, we're seeing an increasing gap between the wealthy and the rest of Vermonters, and you know, it's not just rhetoric; it's really true. And I think when you talk about inequality and how important an issue it is, you have to look at what it means over time. I mean, if we have great inequality, so only wealthier people can afford to go to college, so only those wealthier people who can afford to go to college get the better jobs. You know, it creates this cycle where you create a greater separation between the classes of people. And one thing I want to mention for Vermonters that it's an eye-opener for me is there have been a number of years in recent times when Vermont has had significant declines in median family income, and I don't think we realize that as much as we need to. And if we don't realize it, then we're not going to deal with it. In 2006, according to the U.S. Census, seems like a long time ago, but we had the second sharpest drop in income in the country here in the state of Vermont. And then you look at 2008, we had the highest drop in median family income in the country. 2011, we again had the highest drop in median family income in the country. So, you know, Vermonters talk about working together and being a community and all that, which we are, and it's not a major criticism of Vermont, but it's like a reality check that we don't talk enough about how this gap between the wealthy and the rest of Vermonters is impacting our inability to build a stronger economy. There was some report came out earlier today about unemployment and how, you know, the difficulties of measuring real unemployment and how a lot of people are underemployed and whatnot. But one of the things it said was that businesses are afraid to hire more workers because they're not sure that consumer demand is there to increase their business. And what that tells me, again, is that the best way to allow businesses to hire more workers and grow and strengthen the economy is to increase consumer demand, which sounds like a technical economic jargon, but what it means is to put more money in the pockets of people so they can go out and spend it. If you're only making minimum wage, you're not going to go out on a Saturday night and whip it up and spend a lot of extra money. You're not going to buy a new dishwasher, whatever it is, you know. So we have this increasing gap in Vermont, and it is one of the fastest growing wealth gaps in the country. And it drags us all down. And, you know, I think it was last year or the year before, we were celebrating the fact that Vermont had was one of the few states that saw an increase in median family income. I think it was 2012. And it was said, well, that's great. So we saw this like 1% increase in median family income. That's wonderful. But our median family income, even though it was higher than it was the year before, was still lower than it was in 2001. So, I mean, it's this need to do these reality checks around economic insecurity and economic inequality that I think are really important, and to realize, as you well know, that these situations are based on choices we make. You know, we choose to give tax breaks to wealthy people. We choose, you know, to raise the minimum wage or not. You know, these are choices that, you know, legislators, policymakers, and grassroots organizations are involved in making. And, you know, poverty is up. Well, gee, you know, you don't have to be a genius to figure out why. You look at the fact that, you know, who's paying, who's getting the tax breaks, and who's getting the good jobs, who can afford to go to college. And last thing I would mention is that the Department of Taxes reported that in Vermont between 2009 and 2012, the income of the highest income Vermonters went up almost 75% in that, you know, 4-year period. So if you were wealthy, you saw your income go up significantly. If you were making $50,000 a year, which is, you know, not bad for most people, but it sort of puts you somewhere near the middle, your income basically stayed the same in those years. And if you were making less, $25,000, $30,000 a year, your income went down in those years. So, yes, you know, it's not rhetoric. It's not just us talking about it. So the Vermont Department of Taxes putting out data that says the rich in Vermont are getting a lot richer, and the working folks in Vermont are staying the same or getting poorer. And even if you're staying the same, you're getting poorer because your cost of living is going up. Anyway, don't get me started.
It's hard not to get you started. So just to circle back to what we were talking about with Betsy, I think there's a challenge there for folks who are working on these issues in groups that are activist groups to think about, if it's true that the income gap is widening in Vermont, that means probably in your activist group that's also happening, and to really think about how to bring those conversations into play and make sure we're using the strengths of all the different classes to get us towards a place where we could talk about this a little less.
And actually, another way to put it, if it's not happening in your group, it means your group is not really diverse in any way, because if your group in any way reflects the general population, you've got this growing gap.
Right. So now I want to welcome Kathleen Geyer, who's joining us on the phone. Kathleen is a Chicago-based writer and public policy researcher. Her work has appeared in the Washington Monthly, The Baffler, The Nation, Salon, The American Prospect, just to name a few. She also has her own blog, Inequality Matters. Welcome, Kathleen.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
I'm really excited to have you here with us. So I'd like you to introduce yourself and also tell us a little bit about the CURV Forum at the Nation, which you're hosting, and also about your blog, Inequality Matters.
Well, the CURV is a new project that has just started at the Nation. You can find it at thenation.com/blogs/CURV. And it's a group blog featuring feminist commentary on economic issues. And we started it to address what we saw as two problems. One is the way that women's voices are so frequently sidelined in economic debates. And the other is that even within feminism, we think economic issues tend to be under-discussed. So we're bringing together a variety of women's voices to discuss economic issues that affect women. And then Inequality Matters is my own personal blog. It's inequalitymattersblog.blogspot.com. And it started out with me blogging, you know, writing my own blog post for the blog. But as I'm just doing more professional writing, I'm posting links to my professional writing. But since my professional writing tends to be mostly about inequality, that's what is there for the most part. And I feel really passionately about economic inequality. I think it's the most important issue facing both our country and the world today. So, that's gave me the impetus to sort of start the blog.
Well, thanks for doing it. I've really enjoyed poking around on that blog. And for listeners, in case they missed it, that's inequalitymattersblog.blogspot.com. So while I was doing research for the interview, reading the postings on the Inequality Matters and also on the CURV, I was struck by something that kind of jumped out at me. You have some postings about Linda Tirado and the backlash that she experienced for a writing that she did about what it's like to be poor, basically. And there's also some talk about Sheryl Sandberg and Lean In, and there's some backlash for her. And something that struck me is that, you know, Linda basically got backlash for having daring to say that, you know, I'm poor and that's a problem. And Sheryl Sandberg kind of got slammed because she dared to say that even rich women experience oppression. And you asked a question on the CURV, does feminism have a class problem? And I'm wondering if the real question is whether the growing income inequality we're seeing now that Anthony was just talking about is a backlash against the gains we've made in gender inequality.
Well, you know, I think there is a connection there. I do think that there have been a couple of interesting pieces. I just happened to see one in the Daily Beast today, and Joan Walsh wrote one last week that just made this point that a couple of other people have made that said, you know, isn't it interesting that there's been all this progress in gay rights, which is wonderful and, you know, something that every progressive, you know, should support. But yet women's rights just seem to be stuck. And why is that? And I think the reason is that, you know, women's progress, for the most part, it requires, for women to go forward, I think it requires economic progress. It requires things that cost money, like childcare, like paid family leave, like addressing the gender pay gap. And it requires challenging capitalism, whereas, you know, gay rights, like, you know, like marriage equality, you know, it didn't really. So that's what I think is what women are coming up against. And I think even the recent Supreme Court decision, the Hobby Lobby decision, that's being framed as a cultural issue, but I see it as an economic issue, because it's about challenging corporate America and to sort of, you know, to not to have this paternalistic attitude that they can control what their employees do with their own health benefits. So I think that is what feminism is up against. And that this is the reason why women are having a problem in moving forward. It's the same inequality issues that many Americans are facing, except it's even worse because women are still dealing with these sort of 1950s workplace issues that a lot of the rest of the world doesn't have to deal with anymore, but we still have here.
Yeah, and just to remind listeners, we're talking with Kathleen Geyer, a writer and researcher from Chicago, here on Equal Time Radio. And just to give listeners a little teaser, we will be talking next Monday about that Hobby Lobby case, and we'll have Jill Krawinski from Planned Parenthood as a guest. So, Kathleen, on the curve, one of the things that you wrote was that feminists should put energy into building a movement rather than focusing on elections. I was hoping you'd talk about that a little bit and tell me a little bit about your reasoning behind that and also what it might look like.
Well, you know, I do think elections are important. I think it's important that everyone get out and vote. But I also think the Democratic Party is not really going to move and do very much for women unless, you know, they are pushed from, you know, from people being organized to push them to move. I mean, I was just reading, there's an article in the Washington Post over the weekend about how Obama is going to, he says, this article said he's going to de-emphasize inequality issues. And, you know, I just think he's not really going to, you know, the Democrats are not going to do much on these economic issues unless there is, you know, an organization pushing them to do that. I mean, historically, the way we've moved forward in this country is when you had an organized mass movement pressuring the government to do that. In the 30s, it was organized labor who pressured us. It pressured FDR and brought us the New Deal. In the 60s, it was the civil rights movement that gave us, you know, civil rights gains. And I think unless there's sort of an independent movement that is pushing elected officials to do the right thing, they won't, basically. So I think we tend to put too much emphasis, a lot of activists, on, you know, electing elected officials, but they still don't do much for us. I think we have to build independent mass movements, basically.
So I'm guessing that Anthony Polina has something to say about that. I'm going to let him jump in on this.
Actually, I think she's right. I am, as some listeners know, an elected official, but I spent many years as a community organizer and advocate and coalition builder. And I think I always tell people that if they're waiting for change to sort of spring up from the state house, they better be very, very patient. And where the real change starts is in town hall meetings and around kitchen tables and places where people get together to talk about issues. And, you know, the whole adage, that old adage that if the people lead, the leaders follow, I think is really true. And I think that political parties, for the most part, here in Vermont, we have three major political parties, but the two major political parties on a national level are not that different from each other these days. And I really appreciate what she's saying about how the feminist agenda and women's rights or economic rights, and neither the major political parties on a national level deal with economic issues very well. They don't seem to respond to growing poverty or inequality or any of these other things that are important to the rest of us.
So, Kathleen, I wanted to ask you, do you identify as a feminist, and what does that actually mean to you if you do?
Oh, I definitely identify as a feminist. And for me, feminism means supporting the liberation of women. And it means supporting the liberation of women as a class. That means all women. It doesn't mean valorizing individual women. I mean, it's nice when individual women achieve things in the world, and it makes me feel good, but it doesn't necessarily mean I'm going to support a woman just because she's a woman, like politically. And sometimes I think that's what it means for some women, but it doesn't. To me, the question I will ask about a woman leader is she supporting, you know, women as a class? Does she feel a sense of solidarity with other women? And, you know, that's the thing that's important for me.
So talk about that a little bit. What would it mean to have a sense of solidarity with other women? I think that's related to some of the things you wrote about on the Curve Forum, and I was really interested in those thoughts.
Well, here's what it means for me. Like, I, for instance, during the 2008, when people said, you know, stupid sexist things about Sarah Palin, I said, you know, I wrote that, people, you shouldn't say sexist things about Sarah Palin because it's sexist, even though she's terrible politically. That doesn't give you the right to say sexist things about her. You know, by the same token, it doesn't mean I would support her or any other woman, a female candidate, just because they're female. Like I actually, during that presidential campaign, you know, I'm kind of cynical about politics generally, but I did initially I supported John Edwards' campaign because I thought he would be better overall politically. And then when he dropped out, I supported Obama because I thought he'd be a little bit better than Hillary Clinton. It didn't, you know, just because I'm a feminist, it didn't mean I would support Hillary Clinton just because she was a woman. So, you know, I thought, you know, I care about who I think, which candidate would be best for women overall. And I thought Edwards initially, because he talked more about doing something for poverty and for working class people, I thought he would be better for women overall.
What do you think now?
Well, now I think, God, we dodged a bullet with that one. I'm glad he didn't win. But now I think it probably didn't matter much. They probably would have been all about the same, because I think they would have had all the same structural pressures on them. And what matters is organizing outside of the party. But the same thing applies. I think.
Were you recently? I want to two things. Recently, well, a little while ago, Obama said that inequality was the defining issue of our times, or something like that. Was exactly the words he used,
yes,
which I tend to agree with. But I thought I heard you say a minute ago that he was backing off from that. I'm just wondering if what I heard was right.
Yeah, there was an article in the Washington Post over the weekend where Obama wasn't quoted, but White House sources were quoted as saying that the White House has decided to back off inequality as a theme. Yeah.
So first you say it's the defining issue of our times, and then you say you don't want to talk about it.
Yeah, I think, you know, the Democrats have a problem because they're, on the one hand, by default, they have to be the party for, like, working people, because the Republicans certainly are not. But on the other hand, you know, they are, you know, they have corporate interests that they have to serve at the same time. So they're always being pushed and pulled both ways. And, they do more for working people than the other party. So I always end up voting for them. But
depends
they never
on where you set
do
the
enough,
bar.
You know, and, you know, that's why we're in the mess we're in. So,
well,
it's a problem.
Kathleen, we could talk to you all day, I'm sure, and hopefully people will check out both inequalitymattersblog.blogspot.com and thenation.com/blog/curve. Check out your writing, and is there any last thought you'd like to leave us with?
Stay tuned and look for the next edition of The Curve. We'll be looking at the recent Supreme Court decisions about women from an economic angle. I think it should be very interesting.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us today, and also for doing the work that you do. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Thanks.
So, Anthony, any last thoughts from you on these important topics we've been talking about?
Well, just that I'm glad that, the main thing is I'm glad we're talking about them. No, I'm serious. It's because I think, as I said earlier, we don't talk about these kinds of things enough, and we get satisfied with making little small changes when, in fact, the economy is crumbling around us in terms of what most people are experiencing. You know, we've adapted, and we've become very comfortable with, like, living in a culture where poverty increases and homelessness increases, and more and more people are underemployed or can't afford to go to college. And, you know, a few of us talk about it, but we forget that it's a reality for a lot of people. And, you know, we're not going to solve a problem if we're not willing to talk about it. And it's a big problem. I'm not saying there's any easy solutions, but we started, at least, by raising the minimum. Well, we started the process of raising the minimum wage. Didn't exactly raise. Well, we did raise it a little bit. But I think, you know, we have to continue to make progress on those fronts and not be afraid to have those conversations. I'm glad you're doing it.
So, listeners, here's a challenge for you this week. Start talking about it. Hope you'll join us next week on Monday at 1 p.m. right here on Equal Time Radio.
And you are listening to the Stations of Radio Vermont, locally owned and operated, 96.1 WDEV-FM in Warren, FM 96.5 in Barrie, AM 550, WDEV Waterbury, Montpelier, and serving the kingdom on FM 101.9 from Island Pond. It's now 2 o'clock.
AP Radio News. I'm Tim McGuire. 9 people are dead, some 60 others wounded.